Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fascinating transition.
Damn it!
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that does for comic book movies what Unbreakable does for being alive, damn it. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movie are...
Seb Patrick.
And James Hunt.
We'll discuss the latest comic book movie and TV news before diving into our spoiler-filled discussion of M. Night Shyamalan's 2000 movie, Unbreakable. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seb and James to explain to me a comic book concept that as a movie fan, I just don't understand. And this week, you guys, I just basically want you to catch me up with what's going on in comics. Because I've changed jobs recently, I've moved house, I've fallen way behind on my comic book reading. And I don't think I've read anything that DC or Marvel have put out for about 3 or 4 months. So what am I missing? What should I be catching up on? Have we got past the Captain America and Rebirth like scandals and praise and all that kind of stuff?
So Secret Empire ended with the ending that they said wasn't going to be the ending and actually was the ending. Like, all of that stuff about this is the actual Captain America, this isn't just going to be reversed with the Cosmic Cube. It wasn't the actual Captain America, and it was reversed with the Cosmic Cube.
I mean, it was the actual Captain America.
It was reversed. But it now isn't, because the point is now there are two Captain Americas in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
There is the evil one that was created by changing history, and there is the good one that was created by reversing it, but the evil one still exists. So...
And there's Sam Wilson, but I presume is he back to mean Falcon?
He went back to being Falcon, yeah.
Yeah,
I think he considered the brand tainted.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. Yeah, I can see that. Didn't they do a thing kind of like similar to Superior Spider-Man, where he was kind of like wandering around in like some dreamscape?
It was. I guess you could call it the memory of
the original.
Which is kind of what they did with Superior, but
yeah.
You know how Superior Spider-Man was good.
Yeah. Okay, so what's happened since then? So, James, give me some Marvel stuff first. What's happening in Marvel?
So the next thing that's happening in Marvel is Marvel Legacy, which is Marvel renumbering a bunch of their series as if they had always been continuing with their original numbering. So basically, like, lately the sales have been pretty bad at Marvel, and DC have been getting a lot of good press by sort of courting older readers. And so Marvel's doing their version of that, which is to say, like, hey, it's not like Daredevil issue 18 anymore, it's Daredevil issue 595. Come back if you used to like Daredevil.
Right.
What's
actually happening within that? What's the gimmick?
I mean, I don't really know if there's a story gimmick going on. Like, there is a limited series attached to it, but I've got no idea what's going on in it. And as near as I can tell, like, the story gimmick is we're bringing back classic characters. Like, the Generation X book is featuring the original Generation X team.
Okay, so is it like, I don't know, is Wolverine back hanging out with X-23? Or
like, there's a one-shot where that happens.
Okay.
I imagine, like, I would not be surprised if the original Wolverine is back fairly soon as a result of this. But, I mean, it's all leading up to the next event, obviously, because that's all that happens at Marvel. Which is,
yeah, so this is like a mini event. Like the Captain America Secret Empire was the main event.
Yeah.
This is a mini event, and then there'll be a new big event next year.
Yeah, and the new big event is the return of Jean Grey, which I like in the marketing, they've advertised this as the return of brackets adult Jean Grey to distinguish it from the other Jean Grey that is currently running around.
Right, okay. That's happened before, though, hasn't it? I didn't even know she was gone. Where is she? Where's she been?
She's been dead since Grant Morrison killed her the second time. But she showed up occasionally to be like, hey, don't forget.
Did original Jean turn up, realise that everyone likes Teen Jean much more than they ever liked her, and go away again?
That is scandalous, because Teen Jean is much less interesting than adult Jean.
I disagree. I think, yeah.
Incorrect. My only hope
I
is
always
that
find Jean more interesting as a teenage character.
I would prefer Jean Grey to come back and just, like, I know Cyclops is dead, but I would prefer Jean and Cyclops to be split up.
Well, it's weird. It's weird that we've had so long now since Scott and Emma became a thing. Like it's been established canon for like nearly 20 years. Them as a couple, or at least them as an on and off couple. Like it's been nearly 20 years since Scott and Jean were a couple.
Yeah,
it's just
like
that's not the status quo anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, both Scott and Emma are dead now at the moment, so it's...
I didn't know Emma was dead, but
I'm pretty sure she's dead.
Very much outside of
I didn't read a lot of X-Men while they were dealing with Inhumans, so I'm a bit patchy, but I believe they're both dead.
Speaking of Miles,
yeah,
as I was browsing Forbidden Planet the other day, I saw, like, Spider-Men issue 3, or Spider-Man 2 issue
Spider-Man
3.
2 is finally happening with Bendis and Pacelli. It's weird, though, because up until this point, like, I don't think there's been any impression given in, at least from what I can recall of reading of Miles' stuff, that he remembers that he comes from another universe.
I've been reading it as well. My impression was that he knew, but he just kind of wasn't. It wasn't really anything that
I was
going to
say
about.
He knew, but he'd gotten over it by the time we.
Yeah. But the thing is, he shouldn't have got over it, because it's a really big deal, and the story doesn't work. If you know, he should be dealing with the consequences of that. Like, and so should like Genki and Lana, who I think are the only other two characters who came over.
They don't remember.
I think he remembers because he was with the Molecule Man.
They're dead. Seb, they are dead. All of those people.
That's
are
the
dead.
Thing. Like everyone in Ultimate Spider-Man is dead, and everyone in the Ultimate Universe, apart from the characters that got rescued by Al Ewing in his Ultimates series, in a massive surprise twist.
But so was everyone in the main universe. Everyone in the main universe is dead. There's only like 50 people in that universe now that are the original versions of those of those characters.
But let's not. I don't think Marvel even know exactly what happened there. It's kind of like with DC Rebirth, in that it's just these are the versions now. Yeah. Just go with it. So Spider-Man 2, with as of the third issue, which just came out last week, we finally know who. Well, there's two things. One, we finally know what Peter found when he Googled for Miles Morales. The issue where all of that is explained is a typical Bendis issue, in that it's an entire issue of flashbacks. So, like, we've had three issues of Spider-Man and almost nothing has actually happened so far. But the flashback story of who Miles is so good. And actually, yeah, let's say that we'll have cut out or bleeped me saying that. It's Bendis writing a particular character who I won't name that Bendis always writes brilliantly. So in much the same way as whenever Bendis goes back to Jessica Jones, like, he turns into good Bendis again. He's done exactly the same thing here with this issue and this character. And so it's just a really good flashback one shot explaining who 616 Miles is.
Okay, great. Should we do a bit of DC before we move on? What's happening over
at DC? Yeah, because I don't have a clue what's happening at DC. All I see is things that say DC Metal and have shiny covers.
Yeah.
Are they still in the process of being reborn?
So the books do still have the Rebirth banners on them. We just found out in Action Comics that the mysterious Mr. Oz is not Ozymandias.
Surprise!
It's Jor-El, except it's not going to actually be Jor-El. It's going to be evil clone or something. It's not going to be the real Jor-El, but he was revealed as Jor-El. DC haven't got as far as doing the Superman Watchmen thing yet. That's going to happen, I think, in November. That's kicking off. So that is going to be like they've revealed covers like with Superman on with the Watchmen font alongside it. What's it called? Is it called? I've forgotten what it's called. I'm googling DC Watchmen Superman. It is called Doomsday Clock, and it is essentially a Superman and Dr. Manhattan story from the sound of it.
Jesus. In fact,
Hollywood Reporter have done a story like yesterday with Geoff Johns talking about it, so that probably reveals some stuff.
Can I just jump in with my Watchmen rant here, which is that I don't see how anyone who professes to actually like Watchmen, and this goes for Damon Lindelof too, like, anyone who professes to like Watchmen can work on it in any way.
I agree, but on the other hand, we already lost that battle with Before Watchmen. So if that floodgate's already open, then why not?
And do you not think that, like, Geoff Johns seems like, I haven't read many of his comics, he seems like one of the great kind of salesmen, the great kind of showmen in comics right now. And it feels to me like this being less a case of DC going, everything's going back to the start again, we're stripping things back to basics, jump back on our comics. Because that's what they did with the New 52, and it didn't really work. It seems like what drew people in to Rebirth as a concept was that first issue, was that Rebirth issue 1, which just had everyone buzzing on the internet. Like, it seemed like there were stories everywhere about it. And that it was teeing up kind of like crazy stuff happening with The Flash and crazy stuff happening with Batman, and then there was this Watchmen hint at the end, and everyone went like, whoa, like, I want to stick around to see what happens with that stuff.
I mean, that would explain why it's taken them like 2 years to get to it.
Yeah, well, why rush?
But yeah, I mean, we don't know how that's going to play out until, obviously, it actually starts to come out. But yeah, so Metal is the big thing at the moment. Actually, just before I get on to talking about Metal, because there's two things that I'm buying from DC at the moment that I've actually decided to start buying in print, because I now work, like, literally a minute's walk away from a comic shop, so I've actually gone back onto buying certain things in print. And I wasn't going to with Metal, but I really liked the shiny cover of the first issue. So, especially because the characters on the cover were arranged in such a formation that they were forming a sign of the devil hand sign, like a metal sign. And I just really liked that. But also I was buying something else at the time and I needed another comic to take me over the card limit in the shop. So, because the thing that I decided to buy every issue of in print, and, I think I'm being vindicated because it's selling out and going to multiple printings, is Tom King's Mr. Miracle series, which has had two issues so far. The second one was very good, but the first one is unbelievably good as a first issue.
It's Vision at DC, right?
Essentially, yeah. It's a different kind of thing, and it is a different artist. It's him with Mitch Gerads, who he did... Oh, what is the name of that series that they did together that I haven't read? I'm going to Google again, sorry. I'll know it. I'll know it when I see it.
No dead air.
But, you know, Gerads does the sort of... Is it Gerads or Gerads? I don't even know how to pronounce his name. But does that kind of 9-panel grid thing that Tom King likes a lot. And they work together on a fantastic issue of Batman with Swamp Thing in it as well. I can't find the name. This is all just coming up with stuff about Mr. Miracle. I've totally forgotten the series. Sheriff of Babylon. There we go. It took a long time for that to come up in Google results. But no, it's only two issues in and it's going to be a 12-issue run, but it's really, really great. It's Tom King on really strong form, and it's probably a little bit of hyperbole in terms of like what he's been like over the last couple of years, but I feel like this in particular, and kind of like Vision, is a series that people are really going to remember in future. And it's a really nice one to have as an object, like, you know, to actually have the issues month on month. So, like, seriously, as far as DC goes, be reading that. That is the thing above everything you should be reading at DC at the moment. But Metal is interesting because it's Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, who obviously did that really long run on Batman. Like one of the few unequivocally successful things about the New 52 was that run. You know, they were doing Batman for the entire run of the New 52. And it went on a bit in some places, like they did the Year Zero storyline, which, to be honest, I didn't think was great, but they did some really good work on it. The interesting thing about this is that it's Snyder going a lot more batshit mental. No pun intended, because it is based around Batman. And it feels in a lot of ways like it owes a lot to Grant Morrison in kind of the style of it and the fact that it's based around the DC multiverse, which Morrison's been kind of instrumental in re-establishing with things like Multiversity. And it's weird because Snyder's Batman run felt so much like, you know, he was following on from Morrison's Batman. And to his credit, he really worked hard to establish a tone and a way of doing Batman that was very different from what Morrison had done. So it's interesting seeing him and Capullo now doing a comic that just feels so much like a Grant Morrison series. But the premise of it is essentially that we know about the DC multiverse, but in much the same way as there is dark matter, there is also a dark multiverse. There is essentially a flip side to the entire DC multiverse, but in much the same way as dark matter doesn't interact with matter, the dark multiverse doesn't, except it's starting to do so. There's a whole load of stuff going on.
There's a lot about that science that I take issue with.
Well, it's all theoretical anyway, isn't it? And it's all, the interesting thing about it is, actually, if you go back to Crisis on Infinite Earths, the whole thing was that the anti-monitor came from an anti-matter universe, and now it's like there's a dark matter multiverse, and it's like, that's pretty much the same premise when you, in comic book terms, it's pretty much the same premise when you boil it down.
Is there also a dark antimatterverse?
I don't know. There could well be. Is there a dark antimonitor?
There must be.
Yeah. So it's just basically all about, basically, there's some stuff going on with Batman and this substance, this metal. There's apparently a bunch of different metals. I think one of them is actually called Batmanium or something. It's that level of deliberate ridiculousness, and it's touching on some stuff that was in Snyder's Batman run as well. What it really seems to be about at the moment is throwing a load of crazy stuff at the page, bringing in a load of different evil alternate versions of DC characters, all of whom seem to be versions of Batman. So, like, there's a Flash version of Batman and a Green Lantern version of Batman, but they all look like the Dark Judges from 2000 AD for some reason. They haven't kind of properly turned up in the comic yet, though. And it's really just, as I say, like, it's hard to really get a handle on what's going on at the moment, and it's really just been something to kind of enjoy the ridiculousness of moment to moment. Like, there's been like really great moments, such as using the Darkseid has been turned into a baby and used as a weapon. And the big reveal at the end of the first issue, I say reveal, but what actually happened was it got given to all of the newspapers and stuff. Well, you know, the newspapers that bother to report on comics in America before the comic came out. So it was spoiled for everyone. But the Sandman turned up, the Daniel version of Dream, appeared at the end of the first issue with Neil Gaiman's blessing, and Neil Gaiman has been consulted on it and stuff, because Neil Gaiman has to be consulted if you're going to use Sandman in a DC comic. He's pretty much I think he's the only person at DC or Marvel that has that right over a character that they own.
Want to keep him happy.
Exactly.
So he might do more Sandman.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that from a legal point of view, they own that character, because that character is a derivation of an existing DC character anyway. But they have always taken great pains to consult Gaiman whenever they've wanted to use the Sandman. So
the difference between Sandman and Watchmen is Alan Moore's definitely not going to do more Watchmen for them.
Yeah. So Sandman turned up. We don't know why. We don't know why he's in it, but yeah.
That actually makes me interested enough to go and have a look.
Yeah.
Okay, well, all of that stuff that you just said, Seb, I think might be a good opportunity to segue into the news. Where there hasn't been an awful lot of news over the last couple of weeks, as anyone who listened to the minisode already will know. And we're basically having to take some news that we've already heard on the minisode, that I've already talked about in the minisode, but I thought we could talk about with a bit more depth and get your guys' comic book nerdy eyes on this.
Nerd? It's news to me.
And we'll start off with the DC one, the Arrowverse crossover this year, the Supergirl, Flash, Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow 4-part crossover, will be called Crisis on Earth X. And all of the Visions are going to be kind of like evil doppelganger versions of all of the heroes, which, Seb, sounds not dissimilar to what you were just describing.
Well, to be more specific, actually, and I think you get a hint of this in that poster that they've done for it that Phil Jimenez has drawn, because you can see it in Supergirl's outfit. Earth X is not specifically the evil counterpart's Earth. That's actually Earth 3 in classic DC continuity. That's where Ultraman and Superwoman and Owlman and stuff come from. Earth X, or Earth 10, as it has been re-established as in the post-Grant Morrison multiverse, is the world where the Nazis won World War II and Superman's rocket crashed in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. So it is basically, it's not just that they're evil superheroes, it's that they're Nazi superheroes.
Are they doing Nazis?
Well, look at Supergirl's outfit on that poster. She's wearing a black outfit and her insignia is a red lightning bolt. So that is the costume that the super characters wear in the Nazi-verse comics. One of the issues of Multiversity was about Overman. He's called Overman rather than Superman for obvious reasons.
I guess it wouldn't be beyond the CW shows to do something that nakedly political right now.
I mean, yeah, the timing doesn't seem great, to be honest.
Well, no, I do wonder whether it's intentional. I mean, the season finale of Supergirl last year was called Nevertheless, She Persisted. The episode before that was called Resist. And obviously we saw the pictures of Melissa Benoist, or however you say it. She was on the Women's March last year, and she posted that picture. And you saying that makes me wonder whether they will actually. I mean, I don't think it's going to be the most like in depth kind of like. These are the CW shows. It's probably not going to be like really intelligent satire or anything like that. But you know, it might be a little bit more overt than you would have imagined. Maybe.
Leeson Spencer is going to get an easy time of it.
The other thing that's worth noting about that as well is that they've announced that the Ray is going to be in it, and Russell Tovey is playing him. Which
I love this, Seb. First of all, I love Russell Tovey. I mean, I don't always love the things he's in, but I tend to enjoy him in them.
I just wonder how they're going to fit his ears under the Ray's helmet, because that's a challenge. But he's an openly gay superhero, so that's, you would imagine that the way the CW shows are, they won't shy away from having that be the case as well. And it's, so that's quite an interesting.
Yeah. Let's talk about a show that both of you two do absolutely lap up, and I imagine next year we'll be watching the episodes of as soon as they are available.
Oh, yes. Riverdale. Unless it goes crap. Which is the worry it might.
I think it already maybe tipped into it.
No, it didn't.
It did. The end of
no,
the,
it didn't. The it really, last, no, it didn't.
The season finale was
no,
terrible.
It didn't.
No,
no
it didn't. Wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Yeah.
Who did it?
It was the TV event of the year.
It was that guy. What were you expecting?
Who did it? No one.
I was expecting something on the level of Twin Peaks. Talk about the best TV of this year, you guys, eh? What do you think of the Twin Peaks finale? Did you enjoy that?
I've never watched any Twin Peaks ever.
Oh, yeah, same.
Well, there's some homework. So Riverdale is getting a spin-off. It is going to be called Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Hey, Sabrina, the teenage witch, is it Melissa Joan Hart coming back, you guys? What's happening? Explain
I mean, she has to play Hilda, doesn't she? It's like there's no point doing the show if she's not going to play Hilda.
It's already a given.
For those who don't remember the 90s show, Hilda was the fun aunt, and Zelda, is it, was the stuffy aunt. So yeah, obviously she has to play Hilda.
Play Salem?
Do you know, Reynolds, I had a thought Ryan about that Ryan the other
Reynolds
day.
Pops
someone
up in
that
an episode of Sabrina. I'm pretty sure. So maybe you can get Ryan Reynolds to do a Smurf.
So did... Paul Feig was in it, wasn't he? Maybe they should get him to voice
the character. Was he one of the teachers or
he was
something?
One of the he was a teacher, yeah.
So this character's going to be introduced on Riverdale Season 2 and then is going to spin off into her own series, which I think we were all kind of... Even midway through Season 1, we were all going, oh, is Sabrina going to turn up? I hope she does. And now it's there's no two ways about it. Yes, she will be turning up and... Yes, she will be getting her own show.
Yeah, like, this sounds perfect
for what they're doing.
I mean, yeah, what's interesting is that there, you know, there isn't actually anything supernatural in Riverdale. It just feels like it. Mm. And I kind of like the idea of bringing Sabrina in. What I would potentially like to see is that, like, she, you know, she is a witch and has magical powers, but to the characters of Riverdale, that's not apparent, if you see what I mean. So, like, when she's kind of in her own show, you know that it's real, but it's not that you're suddenly introducing magic and all the other characters in Riverdale are aware of that, because that would change the premise of Riverdale considerably.
Yeah, I would keep so they it have to very ambiguous that balance. And just have, like, unlikely things happening.
I think Season 2 will see supernatural stuff start to seep into Riverdale. And I think it will happen slowly, and I think Sabrina's introduction will be part of that.
I mean,
because it feels like a show where it's already, like you said, like where it's already happening, but we just haven't seen the evidence yet. Like if Jason Blossom walked through a scene in Season 2, I would not be at all surprised.
No, it's yeah.
So yeah, I mean, and I mean, I imagine they'll cast a young actress who we probably haven't heard of.
Mm.
But you're right. I think the things we can speculate and guess about is like, yeah, who might be?
Oh man, a thought just popped into my head though, because I thought, well, maybe they'll cast someone who, like with Cole Sprouse, who famously played a child on a previous program, and now all I can think is that someone have suggested for things before, but it should be Kiernan Shipka.
I was literally as soon as you started talking, I was like, it should be Kiernan Shipka, shouldn't it? Yeah,
it won't be, but that would be awesome
because we're not that lucky.
Okay, but yeah, I think we don't know much about this yet, other than I think it's fair to say that we're all looking forward to it. I mean, I joked slightly with Riverdale. I had a lot of fun with the first season. I don't think I got quite as invested as you guys did. But there's no doubt that it was fun and that it had fun characters. It's just any time a show is that kind of... it embraces its kind of campiness so much... I mean, like, what was it, 3 episodes in that Betty was donning dominatrix gear and torturing someone in a pool? And
I think it was like, a bit later was... in than that. But...
No, it was like episode 3.
And she was like channeling the spirit almost of her missing sister. It was, and I was like, wow, okay, this show is not messing about.
I quite like to stress with Riverdale, actually. You talk about like kind of getting quite invested in it. Getting invested in it is kind of part of the fun, and getting invested in it with other people was particularly part of the fun. It's one of those shows, and it's kind of like when you watch something like The Apprentice or when it was good, The X Factor, you watch it and tweet at the same time because you know other people are. Like, I don't think I would have been as into Riverdale if I wasn't reacting to it on a weekly basis with friends who were also, and it was almost like this kind of over-exaggerated... I think it's a very good show, but I think there's an over-exaggerated emotional investment in it that comes from geeking out with your friends about it, you know?
Yeah, I get that now with podcasts. Like, if I know there's a show that I listen to, like, a reaction podcast about, it's like it's not even the live tweeting anymore. It's like I'll catch up with it, and I know that my fake friends who talk to me through my headphones once a week will also be able to enjoy this alongside me. Ah, okay. Well, that's the CW news from this week then, where it seems like everything's happening. I think we get this every year, kind of the end of the summer is a bit of a dark spot for movie news. Mm-hmm. And I think things will start to kick up a bit. I mean, we're ramping up to a couple of, big superhero movies, throughout the rest of this year. And there's a couple of little pieces of news that are related to the film that we're about to discuss, you guys. And we can probably mention those as part of that discussion, because we are going to move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable. So let's take a listen to the trailer for the movie, and we'll be back with our discussion in just a second. This episode of Cinematic Universe is brought to you by our backers on Patreon. If you head on over to patreon.com/cinematicuniverse, you will see that we have revised our rewards and tiers system on there. And one of the changes we have made is that if you back us at the $20 level, we will plug something of your choice in this special section here, the This Episode is Brought to You by slot. So if you have a look, think, is there anything you would like us to promote on a future episode, then you can throw some cash our way via Patreon. And this is the point in the podcast where we will tell all of our listeners that this episode is brought to you by you.
You're in the emergency room of the Philadelphia City Hospital. I'm gonna ask you some questions. Where were you sitting on the train?
Against the window.
In the passenger car?
Yes.
You're certain you were in the passenger car?
Yeah. Where are the other passengers?
Your train derailed. Took a curve too fast. A second train collided with yours after it derailed. The debris spread over 1 mile.
Why are you looking at me like that?
There are two reasons why I'm looking at you like this. One, because it seems you aren't the only survivor of this train wreck. And two, you don't have a scratch on you.
I know what's going through your mind right now. You're searching for meaning in all of this. Know one thing. 131 people died so you could finally understand the destiny for which you were born. Are you ready for the truth?
Okay, so that was the trailer for Unbreakable, you guys. I wanted to start this off by giving you a look at a few facts that I found on a Wikipedia page. Now, did you know that there are 35 pages and 124 illustrations in the average comic book?
I'm glad you brought this up, because I wanted to do an update to this.
Well, so there's also a single issue ranges in price from $1 to over $140,000. 172,000 comics are sold in the US every day. Over 62,780,000 comics each year. The average comic book collector, in fact, owns 3,312 comics and will spend approximately 1 year of his or her life reading them.
That was from Wikipedia.
That is the opening frame of Unbreakable. What the fuck?
So there's two things here. One, I can actually tell you whether or not I am above or below the average comic collector, because I do actually have the comics that I own catalogued in an app.
I have the same for my movies.
There you go. It might be the same if it's the collectors one. It might, because they do them for various different types of media.
I use Delicious Library 3.
I haven't heard of that.
it's really good, you guys. You scan the barcodes in your phone and it updates your digital DVD shelf.
Yeah, this is the same with this comics thing. And then I use it to generate a list that I have an HTML version of linked to on my site, so that if I'm out and about, I can see what my wish list and what I have is. Nice. Anyway, but yeah, no, I actually only have around about 2,200 comics.
Seriously?
So I'm a below average collector. That doesn't include graphic novels, that's just single issues.
Jesus.
But, yeah.
I think, at the moment, I've got about 6,000, but I think at one point I had like 10, and I've been aggressively selling them.
Well, I can understand why you've been aggressively selling them, if that's how many you've got, but...
That is insane. That's literally insane.
Wow.
But yeah,
I have about 600 films on DVD or Blu-ray. So, I mean, I know that's a lot, but... No, in fact, that's a lie. I have 502. I just opened up my library.
It is... The thing about these facts is that they're... I mean, I can see what it's doing in terms of, oh, this film's going to be about comic books and here's some facts about comics, but none of these facts are either relevant or interesting. Nope. And but I was curious about the one about 172,000 comics are sold in the US every day, over 62 million each year, and I was like, wow, that really paints a picture of a comics industry in really rude health. And like, I bet those figures, like if you looked up a similar figure now, I bet it'd be much lower. And it's actually the opposite, because in 2000 the comics industry really wasn't in great health at all.
I was going to say,
and while 172,000 a day sounds like a lot, it's not really that many. And like nowadays, to be a top-selling comic, you only really need to sell, like the really top-selling stuff might sell over 100,000 copies a month, but you can, in a quiet month, you can top the charts with, like, 80,000 or so copies, if there isn't a big number one launching that same month. But, to my surprise, so that figure of 62.7 million sold per year. I think they've actually only got that. I mean, I don't know where they got these figures from, but I have a feeling they got the 172,000 and multiplied it by 365 to get the 62,780, because that's exactly 365 times that, or they divided the other one. But I went on the Diamond Comics figures. The site is Comicron with a CH, but collates information from Diamond, the comic distributors, and discovered actually that 62 million figure is not actually correct for the year of 2000. In 2000, the total sales just for Diamond's top 300 comics was 69.2 million. So the overall figure, you imagine, would have been higher, because there would have also been the comics outside the top 300. And in 2016... the comics within the top 300 at Diamond actually sold 89.3 million, and everything, like outside of the top 300 as well, the total was 99 million. And that figure has actually been rising steadily over the past 10 years or more. So the comics industry isn't in the best health it's ever been, but actually it was worse in 2000.
I was going to say, 2000 was a real nadir sales.
Well, it was just after Marvel's bankruptcy, and it was before... it was kind of at the beginnings of Marvel's renaissance. Like, Ultimate Spider-Man started to happen that year.
It was before...
I think of
Quesada
sort of 2001 as the year that really kicks it. Quesada come in by 2000, but... I mean, maybe not when this film was being made, but... Yeah, 2000, 2001 is when you had the Marvel renaissance, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And to think, just on this very same podcast, James bristled at me referring to you guys as comic book nerds. So, this title card, or this information card that pops up at the start of the movie, to me, feels more than anything like M. Night Shyamalan kind of... like, this was the sheet of paper he took into his pitch for this movie, with the studio boss and going, look, no, comics are a big deal, you guys. People care about comics.
Look at the potential audience.
Yeah, forget that Batman and Robin just came out. What you don't know is that the superhero movies are about to bounce back in a big old way. You're going to get X-Men and Spider-Man. But obviously, this is, I think, Shyamalan saying, A, to the people who are making his movie, who are financing it, but B, also to anyone kind of watching the film who has at some kind of vague idea that this is comic booky or superhero-y, like, no, you guys, these are a serious art form, and you should be taking this seriously, because that's what I'm about to do for the next 2 hours. You really get that sense. I mean, Seb, you were talking about the way this movie was marketed, and I think that maybe that was reflected in the way the movie was marketed as well, because it's not marketed at all like you would expect. If anyone wasn't around at the time.
It was marketed a lot like, here's another film from
from the guy who did The Sixth Sense. I mean, the posters are just like... It's just moody, scary faces of Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson and some shattered glass. And it's just, it makes it look like, I mean, I was talking to my dad about this. My dad's quite a big fan of this film. And I said, oh, you know, the posters made it look like a psychological thriller. And he said, well, it is kind of a psychological thriller. And I was like, yeah, it is. But it is also a pretty straight down the line superhero origin story. And you could market it as one or the other. But the posters really make it seem like it's a creepy horror film. And it's not that at all. I mean, it is psychological, but it's not. It's not The Sixth Sense, is the point.
It's not The Sixth Sense, because it is a comic book movie, because it is a movie that's playing with the idea of superheroes and comic books. But having said that, I do think it does a kind of like a horror version of that. Not that much that's happening in there is explicitly horrific, but I think the lens through which Shyamalan is looking at these heroes is very dark and twisted, and it is like, I mean, you get the sense almost of like a superhero. Like the powers as a curse more than anything. There's just so many scenes which in another movie would feel triumphant that have this kind of this tinge of horror to them. And I think the one that stands out for me the most is when Bruce Willis towards the start of the movie walks away from the crash from the train crash that kills everyone else. And he walks out and he's the only survivor. And in another film, that could be this triumphant moment of like, Jesus Christ, this guy lived. And instead, what Shyamalan has him do is walk out through a hospital waiting room where the families of everyone else in the crash has sat around who are not going to get to see their living relatives. And Willis feels guilt and nothing else. And you see these people staring at him and not going like, wow, look at this guy who managed to walk away. It's, why did this guy get to survive and the person that I love die? You know, and like the scene where Willis is lifting the weights and this is him discovering his powers, but it's almost like it feels like a scene of trauma for Willis.
And the scene where he rescues the girls is like, you know, that's his big heroic, his superhero launch moment. And that's pretty bloody horrific, especially seeing as one of the people who he's trying to rescue dies or is already dead.
So I don't think that the marketing is entirely dishonest, but I think perhaps maybe the studio were trying to hide more than Shyamalan was that this was a comic book.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily like I say that I think it's dishonest. What I think is interesting is if this film came out now, it unquestionably would be marketed as a take on superhero
Shyamalan
movies.
Does superheroes.
Yeah. It'd be like, and is it a real life superhero movie?
Yeah, you would get a poster that looked like comic book artwork, but, you know, maybe had a sort of slightly darker edge to it or that kind of thing. It would be marketed... I'm not going to say we've marketed like Kick-Ass, because obviously Kick-Ass was marketed in a very aggressive and kind of light-hearted way, but along those lines, but in a way that would be appropriate for the tone of this film. Like, it would make clear to people this is a riff on superheroes, whereas, yeah, it's very much hiding it.
I don't think the movie makes it very clear that it's a riff on superheroes until quite far through, even in itself.
Which I think is another reason why Shyamalan's got that. I think it's constantly.
He wears a superhero costume with his character's name written on it. Like his superhero name is Security, and he wears a cape with that written on it.
Yeah.
He's unambiguously a superhero.
And there's all the comic book store stuff. The thing is, I don't think when I watched this as a kid, I don't think I watched it and went, oh, that's a superhero movie.
I remember watching it in the cinema and not really, like, in the third act, I was like, oh, okay, it's like, he is a superhero now.
See, I saw it a couple of years after it had come out. Riff on it. And I saw it after people had very much talked about it as, oh, this is a film that's about superheroes and, you know, Killing Joke is obviously a big influence on it and that kind of thing. I very much came to it looking for that angle.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I should say at this point, spoilers for all other M. Night Shyamalan movies, and given that he's a twist master, like... If there are any of his other films, because there are various ones will come up, and I'm about to reference a specific one. If you don't want to have any Shyamalan movie spoiled for you, stop listening. So I don't know. We were talking about the marketing and the poster. I don't know whether you recall the poster for Split, which is James McAvoy stood behind some cracked glass, basically.
Yeah.
And now when you see them put next to each other, it's absolutely brilliant. And what I find fascinating is that's another film where he's, from what I've heard, again, I've still not watched it, that is completely transformed you're kind of like, if you watch it a second time in the knowledge that, oh shit, it was a comic book movie again, that you see it through a complete different lens. And I think it's bizarrely easy to miss in Unbreakable that it's a comic book movie, but it's also, once you watch it with that knowledge, it becomes clear quite how explicit it is. And I think that starts off with the way that Shyamalan frames just about every shot. Like, the shots are constructed in a way that the characters always have frames around them. The amount of times that you see Bruce Willis stood through a door frame, for example, or the amount of times, I mean, in that first scene where he's sat between the chairs, the camera's kind of like a couple of rows back from where he's actually sat, and it's sliding between the gaps in the chairs to see him. And every time it's as if there has been this artificial frame constructed around him, and the camera's then moving to get a glance at, okay, now the camera's going to move to this side just so we can see just his hand taking off the wedding ring, and then we're going to move back over to this way so we can see him looking out at the window, and then we're going to move over one more so we can see the girl who's sitting down next to him. And it does it the whole way through. And the one thing that strikes me about this film, and Shyamalan's one of, for me, one of the most fascinating filmmakers of the 21st century, mainstream American filmmakers anyway, just to see kind of what's happened to his career, but also kind of the artistry of this guy, who is kind of like incredibly mainstream, but I think brings something a little bit more than that. And the amount of times that you see that shine through in this film, and it's great just from a comic book perspective to see him doing that and creating this comic book look that isn't so intrusive that it feels like it is like distracting you in any way when you're watching the film, but also like when you spot it, it adds so much more.
I do feel like Ang Lee could have learnt a thing or two from him.
We haven't done that one yet, have we?
No. I mean, Ang Lee did something very similar, but it was distracting.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, I see what you're doing. You're still doing it. Okay. Okay. You keep going. Okay. Yeah, that would be a good one to do.
Here's the thing. I've never actually seen Ang Lee's Hulk. never done it. So that is going to be fun when we get to it on the podcast.
Wow.
It's now at the point where I'm actively like not watching it so I can experience it for the first time when we get to it on the pod.
It has Sam Elliott's moustache as General Ross, which is pretty special. But
always yeah. A treat. So yeah, what's your guys' relationship with Shyamalan then? Like, which of his films have you seen?
I saw this in the cinema, having not seen Sixth Sense.
Wow.
Because
I don't think there's many people around the world who can say that.
I saw this long before I saw Sixth Sense. I didn't see Sixth Sense back when it came out and was a big deal. It wasn't until quite a while afterwards that I saw that.
Well, like, the reason I went to see this was because I used to read a Usenet group called Rec Arts Comics Marvel. And, like, on that, someone did a post saying basically, like, there are a whole bunch of people saying, like, I'm not going to tell you anything about the film, but you guys have to go and see Unbreakable. And so, like, I gathered that there was some kind of comics element to it, but that's all I knew when I went. Just that, and it's the Sixth Sense guy. So me and Nikki went and saw it at the cinema. And she, like, I remember she had seen the trailer and had no idea that there was any sort of comics component to it. She thought it was going to be about a guy, like, figuring out how he survived a train crash.
Yeah. And I mean, and everyone, I think as well, the other thing is that I think a lot of people went into this movie, given that it was Shyamalan, it was like, and this certainly became the case with a lot of his movies following this, okay, what's the twist going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's great about the twist in this movie is that it's kind of there on the surface the whole time. In a kind of the way that it is in The Sixth Sense, that it's all laid out for you, but it doesn't feel like so much of a twist and a shocking reveal in this one. Like, the fact that the fact that Elijah orchestrates the train crash almost to me feels incidental to the fact. I think the reveal is you've been watching a superhero and a supervillain this whole time, and I kind of told you that. Mm-hmm. But how long did it take you to figure it out?
I mean, that's definitely how it came across to me when I saw it the first time.
Yeah, and when you saw it the first time, were you aware that that's what you were watching?
Not, again, given, like, I thought it was a kind of psychological thriller with a riff on superheroes in, and it wasn't until he's, like, in the hood, sort of feeling his way through the crowd, that I was like, okay, he is actually a superhero.
But the, I mean, specifically the twist at the end is the Samuel L. Jackson stuff. Yeah, because by that point, we've seen that Bruce Willis has gone out there and actually tried to become a superhero. But you can, for a lot of this movie, view... Because he's so sympathetic in terms of his backstory, Mr. Glass, as we, you know, kind of like come to figure out, that's who he is by the end of the movie. Mr. Glass is you almost could see him as like the quirky mentor who drives Bruce Willis to become the hero, and not the guy who's long before Willis has turned up embraced the fact that he's the villain.
I can't remember exactly where I figured out that it was him, but it was a kind of a combination of like, okay, this movie's going to have a twist in it, so what's the narrative twist? And the villain's going to be someone we know, otherwise what's the point? And there's only like four characters in the movie, so it's got to be one of them. Like, there was a sort of confluence of all those things that made me guess what the ending was. But again, it didn't really matter because it was like, it was a satisfying ending. So that was enough. Like, it didn't matter that I guessed. It was about him finding out.
Yeah. What about you, Seb? How does it work for you as an ending? Like, even kind of now going back to it and seeing it, knowing full well where it's going, does it feel like the satisfying payoff to this story? Because I think a lot of twist movies can kind of feel like, oh, I didn't see that coming, and then they're not worth it the next time around. I think what marks out early Shyamalan, at least, is that they are endlessly rewatchable in spite of knowing what he's going to pull on you.
Part of the point about the ending here is that he literally says at the end, look, you should have known this from the start. Like, yeah. His closing speech is essentially, yes, I was the villain all along, and look, didn't figure that out from the fact that very early on in the film, I told you that I had a supervillain name. Also, yeah. I dress in purple and I'm in a wheelchair. I mean, he doesn't say that, but, like, you know. And it's like, that is one of the ways in which it rewards being someone who knows the comic book tropes, but the fact that he dresses in purple means that he's the villain, and that is, you know.
Although apparently that was Samuel L. Jackson's idea.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's quite interesting. Because it's like, yeah, the Joker wears purple, the Green Goblin wears purple, Lex Luthor wears green and purple. It's, you know, green isn't so much a villain colour because, like, heroes and villains wear green, but purple particularly.
Samuel L. Jackson suggested purple because Bruce Willis was wearing green, and it's complimentary, so.
Yeah.
I think the hair will have been Samuel L. Jackson's idea. He famously has a hair guy, which is fantastic for a guy who famously has no hair.
I mean, I have a huge issue of dissatisfaction with the ending, but it's not to do with the reveal of Elijah.
It's the card. You've mentioned this on the podcast before, haven't you? It's the end card.
Yeah. What's
the problem with that, Seb?
It feels completely at odds with everything that the film is doing tonally and style-wise up to that point. It feels to me like it's been added on. Like, if you interpret this film as being, in a lot of ways, a riff on Batman the Killing Joke, which I really do think it is, then, you know, you've got an ending where you've got this thing where you've got this, this superhero and this supervillain that essentially can't really exist without each other. Like, Elijah's purpose in life is to find David, and David only knows that he's a superhero because of Elijah. So that's your Batman Joker can't exist without each other relationship.
Yeah.
The handshake is such an obvious, deliberate visual nod to the imminent handshake at the end of Killing Joke. And the whole point about Killing Joke is that it has that ambiguous ending of you don't know what happens next. Like, Does he let him go? Does he kill him? Which apparently is what Grant Morrison thinks, which is ridiculous, but it is a theory. And, you know, or does he turn him over? And, like, I like what I interpret as what I feel, and I don't know whether this is the case or not, but it feels to me like the film, as scripted and shot, ends with David leaving and not knowing what to do with this information, and we don't know what he does next, but that the captions are there to go, oh no, it was all fine, he got arrested at the end. And it's
that's so David Dunn, though, isn't it? Leaving and not knowing what to do next.
That is, you know, in many ways, he's a perfect character for Bruce Willis to play. It's very much Bruce Willis in his being slightly puzzled by everything mode.
This was, and it's a mode that I really like from Bruce Willis, because it feels like a time during his career when he was willing to step. Well, that's the thing. But he was willing to step back and not be the main attraction, to kind of let. I mean, I think the same goes in The Sixth Sense, to let the showy stuff happen elsewhere, but yet also really dig in and deliver.
This is the thing that he spends a lot of this film being quietly grumpy and not much else, but he gets these moments, and there's even things like little moments, like the bit at the start on the train where he's flirting with the woman, and when he takes off his wedding ring, the scene at the breakfast table with the newspaper when he passes his son the newspaper. For Bruce Willis, he's doing an awful lot of silent acting it's great.
This is still probably my favourite Bruce Willis movie, like, aside from possibly Fifth Element. Like, performance-wise, I think he's doing a lot more in this than he's done in anything else. Because he's just being, like, generic action guy, and he's very amiable, but he's not really acting.
I think normally is a hard word to throw at Bruce Willis, given the kind of the peaks and troughs his career has gone through.
You do get vast discrepancies in how interested Bruce Willis is at any given time, don't you?
Yeah, and I think he can be fantastic, but I'm looking at this stage of his career. I mean, so he had The Sixth Sense and The Whole Nine Yards in 1999-2000, which I don't think The Whole Nine Yards is a great movie, but it was a big hit for him. He's fantastic in Disney's The Kid around then. And then, like, it seems to go into a bit of a trough after that. And he has picked up and done some, like, some interesting stuff since then.
I've just realised why this conversation is familiar, and it's because we did Sin City 2 episodes ago.
Yeah. That, I think, is a vastly different performance to what he's delivering here, because... Yeah. Yet he seems kind of, like, restrained in Sin City, but there's nothing interesting about his performance. Seb, as you were talking about that scene at the breakfast table, I've got the film on mute in the background just so I can kind of watch it as the podcast progresses, and that scene was on when you were talking about it, and I'm watching it, and the silent communication between him and his son, and this, like,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
The kind of, you can see the emotion for Bruce Willis, for David Dunn in that moment, of being able to finally connect with his son and to know what it's like for his son to be properly proud of him. And I think the son has been proud of him before that, but it's like he hasn't felt like he deserves it. But in that moment, he does. And it feels like so emotionally rich. And I think you give credit to Shyamalan, who obviously got two really strong performances out of Bruce Willis in back-to-back years. But, you know, you've just got to say, yeah, I don't know whether it's Bruce Willis's best performance, but it's certainly up there. It's certainly, you know, it's a tough one to argue that it isn't. You're right. I think he gets those moments fairly regularly throughout the film.
There's the gun scene as well, that is a, you know, even watching it again and, you know, not having seen the film for a long time, you know, knowing that obviously, although I think at that point I couldn't remember if he actually shoots him and it bounces off or if he just puts the gun down. It's a tense as hell scene. It really is.
Yeah. And it is because you feel in that scene, and I think the way that you would obviously see that the first time is that I think you suspect that he is unbreakable, that he does have these, that he's right. But there is that, in that scene, there's the panic that A, what if he isn't? And B, what if he's right? And what if it does bounce off? And then what does that mean for his marriage? And what does that mean for everything else? And, you know, and also just the terror of, like, this is a kid with a gun in his hand in the kitchen. Like, what if he hurts himself? What if he hurts his mum? Like, it's... And that's another one of those Shyamalan doing a kind of, like, a superhero having a gun pointed at him who's going to be invulnerable to that bullet. In so many superhero things, that's just cool, isn't it, when the bullet bounces off him. The prospect of that happening in this film is horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying, and you sense it in that scene.
That's like Shyamalan's quality as a filmmaker, is that he's like, this is, we were saying just before we started recording, like, this is the time in his career when people were going, like, he's the new Hitchcock, because he was so good with, like, suspense and tension.
Well, like, you know, in his next film, which is a film that gets derided for, and not without good reason. But it does contain...
It's a good movie.
It does contain a scene that, now, admittedly, as someone who doesn't go to see horror films, it contains a moment that is maybe the scariest thing I've ever seen in the cinema.
I think, again, we've talked about this possibly not on the podcast before, but, like, that scene of the aliens, like, in the home movie footage.
Yeah, that's what,
I'm someone who does not get affected by horror movies at all, but that one, like, properly fucked me up.
Well, that's it. I think Signs is Shyamalan's last good movie in that period, anyway. Because
I like it while acknowledging the criticisms. Yeah.
I get some of the criticisms, but I still think it's effective in what it sets out to do. The Village doesn't work for me. Never really has. Lady in the Water and The Happening and The Last Airbender are flat out really bad. As is After Earth, to be honest. And The Visit, I thought, was an interesting kind of return to form for him. But those first three films, I think the one thing that he's fantastic at doing, Shyamalan, is injecting these moments of, like, horror into the everyday. And that's why I think that the moments are so scary in this movie that, you know, you could in another context see as triumphant. They're so scary in this film because it feels like he's injecting them into real world situations. Like, it's so downbeat because it's just like, this is just, it's run of the mill stuff. And the, like, a superhero or a supervillain, like, causing a train crash in something else might be like the inciting incident. In this, it feels real, you know. It feels like a real world tragedy.
It's like, you're right. It's I'm thinking as well of the scene where they're like asking, you know, have you ever been ill? Have you ever had an injury? And like, that should be a big sort of in like triumphant moment. But the realization that he hasn't comes across as like scary and weird and upsetting.
Yeah, and I think the way the performances are given and the way the characters are introduced and stuff as well, and even the way that they dress. I know you talked about the colours, but like the fact that he's wearing kind of like this, like Bruce Willis, this schlubby bald guy wearing this like this greasy mac that he goes out in, whereas you've got the charismatic Samuel L. Jackson, who has this sympathetic backstory and, you know, looks cool. And you just like, you feel almost throughout the first act. To an extent, Samuel L. Jackson disappears from this movie in the second half for a point when we're actually getting into the superheroics. But like early on, you're like, one of them feels like more conventionally the hero than the other one. You know, you don't tend to introduce your hero with him slipping off his wedding ring on a train, leering over a younger woman, essentially, and creeping her out to the extent that she runs away. You know, do you know what I mean? And so, like, it feels like for so long that your hero's your villain and your villain's your hero.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not entirely sure what Shyamalan's trying to say there. But I think it works for the movie because maybe just in the fact that it throws you off the scent, if nothing more. I did want to ask you guys about, though, like, given that Shyamalan's riffing on comic books, and I know, Seb, you've mentioned The Killing Joke as like a thematic comparison. Quentin Tarantino has said famously that, you know, he thinks this is like one of the best Superman movies ever made, and that's how the film should have been marketed. Do you see direct comic book parallels between these two characters and characters in the comics? Are there direct parallels, or are they kind of amalgams of other
characters? What, between David and Superman, you mean?
Yeah. So is David Superman here, essentially, or is he Batman as like the Killing Joke thing, or is the fact that he's just kind of like, he's just a regular dude who has these powers? He's got a spidey sense as well, doesn't he?
There's just a lot of archetype stuff going on. I mean, even the fact that he's called David Dunn.
Yeah.
It's the alliterative name.
I think he's more of a riff on like sort of 60s Marvel characters than anything.
He is definitely more Marvel than DC.
Yeah.
Because
he's flawed.
Yeah, and
yeah, just a bit,
and you know, yeah, Elijah. It's stuff like the, you know, the villain is always in the wheelchair, apart from Professor Xavier, and he wears purple and he has slightly crazy hair, and he's called Mr. Glass. You know, it's like the villains are always Mr. or Doctor rather than something man. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't tie it to a specific pairing of characters, because that's not really what it's about. It is about drawing on the archetypes and about, well, I mean, I wouldn't even go so far as to say that the film is, I don't think the film is really exploring what comics are all about. It's obvious that Shyamalan likes them and likes the kind of the trappings and the mythology and stuff, but I don't think this film ever really is trying to say anything about what superhero comics are there for and how we relate to them and that kind of thing. Other than it being sort of that nice little thing that is this kind of little beacon of hope for Elijah when he's a child. I really like that thing about how he gets into comics because his mum gives him them as a present, you know.
That's the twist, though, isn't it? Is that it is presented as the beacon of hope for him as a child.
And then what turns him into a murderous terrorist, yeah.
And so I wonder then whether that's the interesting thing that's going on here, is that it's not that comic books are presented as, like, oh, you're actually watching a comic book story. It's that a character sees comic books and finds a framework for his life in them. And so he kind of... he kind of projects comic book tropes into the real world and goes, oh, well, obviously
it's kind of like Scott Pilgrim with video games, isn't it? It's the lens through which you view the world.
But it's the lens through which Elijah views the world, because he, without comic books, would he just be this guy with this horrendous illness, or would he be...
Or would something else have caused him to go down the same route?
Frederick Witham was right, that's what we're saying here, isn't it?
And I do want to shout out again, like, a lot of the direction from Shyamalan and the way that he presents the two main characters in this film. Mr. Glass is so often shot through, like, we see him through reflection. The entire first scene where the doctor comes and sees Elijah's mother is shot in a mirror. The scene where his mum is talking to him about going outside early on is shot on the reflection on a TV set. And then when he goes outside and he looks at the comic book, he's looking at it upside down. And then the camera, even as he turns it round to himself, the camera turns around with it. So even though he's now looking at it straight, it's still upside down. And so there's this constant reminder, like these filmmaking reminders, that this guy is the reverse of this. You know, this guy is the mirror. This guy is looking at it the wrong way around.
This is the sort of thing
to him being the villain.
Like, I always wonder, like, is this good filmmaking or is it bad? Because on the one hand, it's so overt that you can't miss it, and like you're watching that instead of the film. And on the other hand, it's actually quite clever and does say something about the characters and the story. And it's like, is it good or bad?
I don't think it distracts, though. I don't think it distracts.
If you get to the point of thinking like, oh, I see what they're doing, and like you still see what they're doing well after you've noticed it.
I don't know. I think sometimes it comes down to, are you actively looking for it, or is it something that, like, what I try and tend to do with movies is the first time I watch them, if I was a critic, actually, like back when I was actually regularly reviewing stuff, I'd sit there with a notepad. But I tried not to, because I like to, the first time I see a movie, just soak it in and then go, all right, if I enjoyed that, I now want to
I'm totally the opposite, which is that as soon as I'm watching a film, I'm pulling it to bits from like the first frame. Like, I just can't help myself.
Well, sometimes, and I think there's some stuff you notice, but for me, a film like this, I mean, and I can't remember the first time I watched it, and probably when I first watched it, I was too young to be watching it through anything like a critical eye. But the first time I watched it, I was just like, oh, cool. And now when I go back and watch it, I see that stuff. But I don't. Why I don't think it's distracting, or why I don't think it detracts from the movie, is because it's also really beautifully shot. Like, I think the way the camera moves, so, and the cinematographer here is Eduardo Serra, who we should mention because I think he's so critical to all of this. But the shot in the TV, for example, I just think it looks really great. I mean, this film is so kind of like, it's so coldly shot, you know. It's very grey and it's very blue. And I think that when the individual images are still as gorgeous to look at as they are, that even if I'm noticing that stuff, I'm noticing them but going, yeah, okay, great. that looked really great. And I'm willing to give Shyamalan all the credit in the world for that, because I really don't think it distracts. In fact, I think it gives you those little hints, but it helps contribute to the overall mood of the movie. Again, the kind of like the always framing David, it kind of feels like you're taking a step back and you're watching everything through like at a bit of a remove. And I think that's the way that you should be watching the character of David Dunn, because he is kind of such an insular, restrained character that feels the best way to kind of like coldly observe him from one remove. I think this film is one of the most interesting directed films that we'll get on the podcast.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But I think Shyamalan became a laughingstock, and I think it's, like I say, it's slightly deserved. I think he believed his own hype. I think he I think he bought into the wrong aspects of what made him a good filmmaker. Hmm. And I mean, certainly if you watch Lady in the Water and kind of watch the stuff that he does with the film critic in that and some other stuff, you're just going, okay, this is a guy who is too up in the idea of M. Night Shyamalan, the filmmaker, and not enough in what makes a good Shyamalan movie and continuing to make them. And I'm really hoping that he's back in that mold. And I'm so excited, you guys, to see what happens when we revisit these characters, because we know that David Dunn and Elijah are both returning for Glass, which is, again, spoiler, there's the sequel to both Unbreakable and Split, and will feature Bruce Willis, James McAvoy, Anya Taylor-Joy, Samuel Jackson. We just found out that Spencer Tweet Clark, who plays his son in this, is reprising his role.
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What about Robin Wright?
Robin Wright hasn't been announced yet, but Elijah's mother, played by Charlaine Woodard, is also reprising her role. So it'd be interesting if Robin Wright does. I think someone else got added to the cast recently, actually. Someone who hasn't been in who wasn't in either film. I'll Google that. But yeah, are you excited to see these characters again? I mean, like, I don't know whether you guys have got around to watching, if either of you have got around to watching Split yet, but
I haven't. But I've watched the. I don't even know if it's a post credits or if it's just the end. But I've watched the scene with David in right. it.
I haven't watched Split because just everything I saw of James McAvoy in it just made me cringe so hard.
Sarah Paulson, by the way. Sarah Paulson is the person who's been added to the cast.
Yeah, I was just like,
it is actually.
No, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, the scene is actually, it's simultaneously both good and bad. It's good the way it sort of pans to reveal David Dunn there. What's really bad is that that's led into by, it's a bunch of people in a diner watching a news report about what's just happened in Split, and a woman goes, "That's like that." That guy 15 years ago who called it, what did he call himself? And then, like, it pans across to David Dunn and he says, Mr. Glass. And it's like, just, no one would ever say, oh, that thing where someone was a bit evil, that's a bit like that guy 15 years ago.
Do you know where they would say that, Seb? Do you know where they'd say that? They'd say it in a comic book.
In a comic book. All right.
Yes. He's nailed it. And also, when you're setting up a backdoor sequel to a film that you made 17 years earlier, I think we can forgive him being as on the nose as possible.
I do. What I'm intrigued about is for Bruce Willis to have agreed to appear in Split like that, he must have been sold. Well, either they drove a dump truck full of money up to his house, or he has been sold on whatever Shyamalan wants to do with the next one.
I think Bruce Willis doesn't give a fuck anymore, and he has his price and will turn up for it.
Okay, but no, what about Samuel L. Jackson? Samuel L. Jackson
would turn up for anything.
He'd
turn up for a freaking Mars bar.
I was being sarcastic.
Okay.
I think that Shyamalan has obviously been talking about wanting to do or being interested in doing a sequel to Unbreakable for a long time. And I think Bruce Willis has always kind of been on board for it, kind of saying, yeah, I mean, like, if he does it, I'm interested in going back to that. It's probably a film that, you know, like, they had a good working relationship together. It's probably a film that Willis recognises was well received, and if there's enough buzz out there for them to actually go and make the film, why wouldn't he? And I think it's something that they were kind of kicking around for a while, and it sounds like there was kind of like Shyamalan was making another film or had an idea for another film, and it kind of came back together with what he was originally planning to do for an Unbreakable sequel. Because he said kind of way back when, if I ever make a sequel to this, it'll be very different. And the fact that he managed to get it out there into cinemas without it being common knowledge is like such a magic trick in and of himself. I mean, like, last year they almost got that Blair Witch film out, didn't they, without revealing it was Blair Witch, until they went, no, do you know what? Let's tell everyone just in case, because were a bit worried. The fact that they got this all the way to cinemas, the fact that they market it just as, yeah, it's just a horror movie with James McAvoy in it. And then had this at the end and had everyone kind of on board and waiting to go for a sequel. I love just the process of that. I love the, like, it does to me, it like harkens back to Shyamalan the Showman. And I mean, yes.
It's sort of interesting, isn't it, how if you look at the context of when Unbreakable came out, like, the most popular superhero movie was Batman and Robin. Or, like, at a stretch, sort of, you had, like, Superman, Batman, Batman Returns, and then a bunch of absolute crap.
It's Blade and Batman and Robin in the kind of the years leading up to this, isn't it?
Yeah, and then, like...
And, yeah, Unbreakable, I suppose this did come out after X-Men, but you can't judge it in relation to that. Yeah. Because,
no.
It's just, yeah, Unbreakable, like, was far ahead of its time. And now it's kind of nice that it's come back around and he's getting to maybe reap those benefits a little bit.
Well, it's the thing, because I think what's interesting about Unbreakable, it's what I was saying to you before about, you know, I don't think it really gets into what comics mean. I think it's using them as a hook. And I think part of the reason for that is, in 2000, would anyone be interested in that? Because we haven't had a decade and a half of massively successful comic book-based movies. Now that we have, if he's going to do that with the next... And I'm not saying he necessarily is, but what I would like to see with the next one is a bit more of a, you know, taking into account the context of those last 17 years worth of movies, doing more of a riff on that. I'm not, you know, saying, again, do it as a straight-up parody. I mean, that has already been kind of done. But a little bit more of it, you know, assuming a bit more understanding of people, of, you know, comic books being in people's consciousness, even if they don't necessarily read them.
Well,
but comic book and superhero tropes. Superhero tropes are much more in people's consciousness now. Also, I think people are more accepting of a collision of genres between superhero and other genres. You know, I would continuously argue that superhero is not a genre. And, like, you know, plenty of recent films have shown us that. So, again, yeah, I think there's scope for another film that's like Unbreakable, but gets to actually be a bit more confident in being about what it's about.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see what the focus is. So the log line, from what I can tell, is that David Dunn is chasing down Crumb in his Beast persona. So that's kind of like the final personality that McAvoy assumes in Split. While Mr. Glass is revealed to have masterminded events for both men. So, and it's interesting as well that kind of like the... I think the this is like a superhero universe where the powers are grounded in both kind of like a physical illness almost. So, like, I think Shyamalan is playing with mental disorders in Split, but perhaps not in the best taste, but he is. He's kind of taken like a real disorder and kind of twisted it to become a comic booky version of that. I think in the same way he has done with both characters in Unbreakable. But there's also trauma kind of at the center of it for all of them. And from what I've heard about Split, that's very kind of central to that as well, and not only to the main character, but to the Anya Taylor-Joy character as well. So yeah, I'm interested in a M. Night Shyamalan superhero cinematic universe grounded in kind of like in more in trauma than in any kind of like normal superhero tropes. And you're right, Seb, I think it would be fascinating if he then does take a step back and kind of look at comic books. Because the first two films, it sounds like, are both films that, like, you're going, we're kind of taking a step back and not really wanting to play our hand too much in that this is a comic book movie. Once you've got an Unbreakable sequel that features all those characters, that's up front. We all know now that that is a movie playing with comic book tropes, which would be the perfect time to then go, okay, let's examine them.
I mean, do you think it's going to do that with comic books, though, or do you think it's going to do it more with movies? Because that's, like, for me, suddenly turning Unbreakable into a cinematic universe is... It's more of a riff on what's been happening with movies than it is with what's been done with comic books over the years.
I mean, I use the phrase cinematic universe. From the way that Shyamalan's talked about this, it sounds like it is the third part of a story, and that it is, and that that's it. It's not going to be then launched.
Well, no, yeah, but
all
like,
of these different ones. But it's just going. Here's an opportunity to bring these characters back.
But I mean, doing the thing of linking one movie to another in the final scenes, like that is a superhero movie trope, isn't it? Of saying like,
yeah,
this is actually with that and the next movie, you're going to see them both together. Like that, yeah. You know, it's, I'll be interested to see if Glass is more of him talking about like the way that superheroes have dominated cinema. And whether or not that's a good thing, that's what I'll be expecting of it more than what about comic books?
Yeah. My other hope for it is it's Shyamalan having fun again. I was saying, I think that like, I think he got bogged down for a while, and you can feel in The Visit that this is a guy just who seems to be enjoying what he's doing, seems to be enjoying, like, just letting the shackles off, and also feeling confident as a filmmaker again. I really think that is what kind of chipped away at Shyamalan, was that he started to not, like, he believed his own hype, and then it flipped too far in the other direction. And I think when you see how confident in a filmmaker he is in this and The Sixth Sense. Like, he totally believes that his ending is going to stand up to scrutiny. He totally believes that his audience are going to be taken on the journey that he expects them to be taken on. And he's proven right in both of these. And I think to an extent in Signs, not quite as much as he is in these first two. Yeah, and that's what I want to see him doing again. And I can't lie, like, just the idea of a sequel to this movie, not even because it's a superhero movie, just because I think like this is a really great movie, and it's got such a style and panache to it, but it's also doing fun superhero-y stuff.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't there?
I want to see more of it.
When you see a superhero origin story, you always want to know, like, and now what? Like, in the movies, in the comics, like, that's always the lingering question of, now you're a superhero, so now what?
Well, now presumably he's been chasing down bad guys for the past...
Not quite.
15 years.
Well, maybe he's been hanging around for 15 years waiting for another one to turn up.
Yeah, perhaps just never taking off that mat.
Mm-hmm.
Is he in it in that scene, Seb?
No, he's not actually. No, he's wearing a shirt with his name on it, so it suggests that he's still working as a security guard. It's like he's wearing a uniform. It's like a kind of light blue shirt with a name badge on it.
Yeah, I would suggest he loses the red baseball cap that he wears in the stadium this time around.
Yeah.
God, can't look at one of those anymore, can you, without... is there anything else we want us to say about Unbreakable itself? It's funny, isn't it? I think it's plot-wise, there's weirdly not an awful lot to it.
I find it quite interesting that it doesn't have a third act. It's particularly if you look at the kind of the superhero origin story tropes. It has the first act, it has the setup, it has the second act with him becoming the superhero, it has that big sequence with him rescuing the family.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And then you go to the gallery, and you kind of expect that something big is going to happen, and it just doesn't, it just ends all of a sudden. It's like, oh, okay. I don't know if there's anything kind of missing there. I do know that, like, the most expensive scene in the film was cut out. It's on the deleted scenes, but it's Mr. Glass on a roller coaster. Other than that, you know, I don't know if there was anything intended to sort of, but as I say, I mean, I don't know if Shyamalan's talked about it. I don't know if there's any kind of evidence out there of what was in shooting scripts and stuff, but it really feels to me like not only is the ending abrupt, but that somewhere along the way there was pressure to go, hang on, you can't let the terrorist get away with it once he's been revealed. Because it's just everything about the tone of that scene and the way that David reacts to him and the relationship they've had throughout the film, it just does not seem like the next thing that happens is, oh, he gets arrested and gets put in a mental institution.
It's not even like, it's the way it says, like, he went to the authorities or whatever.
Yeah,
so it doesn't feel right, does it?
It doesn't even feel like those words have been written by M. Night Shyamalan, like, you know, the way that he scripts the rest of the film. It doesn't seem like his kind of language, you know. But aside from those concerns with the ending, like, I knew going into this, like, not having seen it for probably over 10 years, but, like, I knew going into this is meant to be a really good film, and I remember enjoying it. I really did enjoy rewatching it. I think it is a great film. It's flawed, but I think it's a really good film. I think in a difficult role, Robin Wright is very good as well.
I wouldn't call this out as like one of those movies that we criticize for its female roles. I think she's a function in the story in the same way that almost every character who isn't Bruce Willis or Samuel L. Jackson is, you know?
Mm.
I think she does the best with a bit of a thankless role. I think Spencer Tree Clark's pretty good, and it must have been absolutely horrific for that poor kid who had to follow up Haley Joel Osment.
I was going
to
say, it's like, yeah, it's like, sense. He's a guy who looks a bit like Haley Joel Osment, but isn't, and like, yeah, is having to be the kid in a Night Shyamalan film. I think he's fine. He's not really, has he done much else? I don't remember, like, anything.
But. He was the son of Baron von Strucker in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and he was in the Mad Men finale, apparently, as well.
There we go. I do want to go back to what you're saying, kind of, about the structure of the film, Seb, because I agree, the ending does feel abrupt. It's a very oddly paced film, because you know, it's an hour 45 long, and it feels like so much of kind of like the iconic moments of this film are up early in the first 45 minutes to an hour. And it feels like I said, like after we kind of lose Samuel L. Jackson as such like an integral part of the narrative, it's when he falls down the stairs, and which I have to say is one of the most... I rewatched this a couple of months ago with my wife, and she, like, you know, gasped and winced and turned away from the screen during that scene where Samuel L. Jackson's falling down the stairs.
Yeah,
at that point, you're so aware, and the way that he builds up the tension in that scene, you kind of can almost like, and the way that you see the cane shatter before you see any of the impacts for him, you kind of hear stuff, then you see the cane shatter. And it's then Shyamalan going, and that's what's happening to his bones right now. Mm. It's horrific. It really is horrific. But after that point in the movie, it's weird. There are kind of like really good bits here and there, but it does feel kind of oddly paced. And you're right, the bit where he goes out and does his superheroing, you expect to be half an hour from the end. And he finishes it, and there's two more scenes. There's the breakfast table, and there's the gallery scene. It feels abrupt, but I also do really like it, and it does. I don't know. It does to me kind of feel like the end of a first issue of a comic. You know, like everything's ramped up, and then like we read the last two pages, and like, all right, okay, and so now you want to come back next time now, don't you? Which you just. Like, I kind of feel like a lot of these films, like, you know, you're like, oh, why are people still going on about a bloody sequel for this film? Just because it's superhero related. But I do watch the end of this film and go, oh no, I want to see more. I do want to see more. I know why we've been bugging him for 15 years. So I'm definitely glad that it's happening. We're all thumbs up on Unbreakable, are we, you guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think as a film, I think it's great. As a riff on the genre, I think it's, you know, it's not as interesting now as it was in 2000. But I think in 2000, it's a very strong riff on the genre. I think we've just had more done with it since.
Yeah, I have one question before we go. where does it make less sense that water is the...
when we were talking about science before,
here,
I was like...
Or is it science?
I kind of think it's worse here, because...
Comes out not. It doesn't really feel connected. It's like, oh, does the hero have to have a... He has to have a kryptonite, doesn't he? So let's...
Well, that's the thing. Water? Like, most superheroes don't have a kryptonite. Only Superman has a kryptonite.
Yeah, and also, it feels like it's only there because there needs to be an explanation for how he can have nearly drawn as a kid. But if you're drawing on Superman, like, there's plenty of versions of Superman where he doesn't have his powers as a kid and only gets them later. And it's not even like it's there as a possibility for why he got injured in the car crash, because it's reasonably early on that Elijah concludes that David wasn't actually injured in the car crash.
I think it's more interesting if the car crashes when his powers manifest, you know?
Yeah, and
it'd
also
be almost interesting if he was a sickly kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I guess just...
But then he wouldn't be a direct opposite, so...
Yes, that's the thing. That is the thing.
And it's... The problem with it being water is just... How often is it going to be the case that he's going to be trying to be a superhero and then it starts to rain? But then is that why he wears the...
Well, that's the thing, isn't it?
That's why he wears the poncho. Yeah. That's because that actually protects him from the rain, so he can actually still
The thing is, I don't think water literally takes away his powers. Like, it's just he falls into a pool. But they establish water as his weakness. And so when he's doing the big fight and stuff, they're like, let's put around lots of water because then that implies jeopardy.
Mm.
Like that's, yeah. I think that's a filmmaking trick more than a narrative one.
and if he's the mirror to Glass, if Mr. Glass gets rained on, does he like gains?
Does he become powerful?
Or strength or something?
No, well, you know,
it's just a bit silly, isn't it? It's silly on in the same way that aliens come to a planet that is 70% water.
If water is his weakness, like. He's got a lot of that inside him, so surely he should never have his powers because he's literally always in contact with water because he's made of it.
I buy it as he can. Okay, so he can drown. Yeah. That's how you can kill him. It's like I don't know, decapitating certain mutants or whatever. That's how you can do it.
Wolverine can be drowned, apparently, or at least Wolverine's son could be drowned because that's how he killed him.
Or Wolverine could be drowned in adamantium, like happens to Lady Deathstroke.
Yeah, that's also how he drowned, and that's how he died, is that he got encased in adamantium. So.
Yeah, I've seen that. In fact, I might own that comic. I got given a copy. it had a shiny cover, which works for Seb, so it works for me. I think that's everything. What I would like to put to the listeners, and we're not going to do this anytime soon, but we've been having lots of kind of like agonizing on the podcast about whether we should cover Split and when we should cover Split. So it would be good to hear from you listeners whether that's something you want us to do soon, because we're aware again that it's like it's a movie that is not supposed to be very comic booky until the twist at the end, and then you can kind of see that he's playing with some tropes. So we're wondering, whether you'd like us to do it, and if we should be in any hurry to get to it. Should we get to it before Glass, basically, which I think is a film that we will almost certainly cover when it is released on the podcast. So maybe we'll put something out on Twitter, and you can, or just tweet us and let us know what you think about that. But that was Unbreakable. Should we get some recommendations based on Unbreakable, you guys?
Yes. Seb, do you want to go first?
Go on then. Yeah, this is a tricky one, because I do think that we talked off mic before about how I think the best thing to recommend for this is something that's already been done, which we did for Kick-Ass, which was Superman Secret Identity,
which I loved, by the way. It's one of my favorite recommendations on the podcast. I own a copy myself now, so
it's legitimately one of the greatest comics ever published. If you somehow have never read it, listeners, then do so off the back of this, because the premise of that is, what if somebody discovered they had superpowers like Superman in a world where you know who Superman is and that he's a comic book character? And oh, it's just wonderful. It's a perfect comic. It is one of those I just go back to every so often and just give it another reread, because I just get so much joy out of it. But I'm not recommending that this time, because you've already done it and you've already raved about it. I am going to actually suggest a further volume of something that you've previously read on the podcast, though. Because
it's probably in which case, Deb, it's probably something that I've said on the minisode, and so I really like this. I'm probably going to read some more of this and never got around to doing it. So often on the podcast, and I'm like, I wish I had the time to actually do this. So it's great that.
But I am going to annoy you by getting you to skip on a volume because I know you hate.
You might
have to just read the second volume as well. I kind of got to thinking about, even though this film isn't really meta, it is about comics and about comics as a form and like the kind of historical context of them. So it is kind of a meta commentary on comics in a sense. So I thought about comics that are metatextual, and so I landed on the most obvious one, which is the third and final volume of Grant Morrison's run on Animal Man, which is called Deus Ex Machina. I don't know if you did go on and read more Animal Man after reading the first volume.
Never got around to it.
So, as I say, you can read the second volume if you want, but the third volume, I think, is self-contained enough as a story. I mean, actually, there's kind of a through thread, but there's also a few individual stories that it hops around between. But the through thread through that is Morrison playing his end game of turning Animal Man into a comic that is about the fact that it's a comic. I don't know if you already know or have had spoiled what happens in the last issue. Issue 26, the last issue of the volume, the last issue of Grant Morrison's run, is one of the most famous single issues of the modern era for a very specific reason, but I don't know if you know what that reason is or not.
I think, do you know what? Probably yes, but I can't remember, so I'll imagine what will happen is I will read it and go, oh yeah, that's the thing that's in the back of my head.
So I'm not going to say it's anything like this, and I'm not going to say it's really an inspiration for this, because actually, again, the other thing I probably would have recommended was Killing Joke, but you did that a long time ago as well.
That was on our Batman 1989 episode.
Which is like our second ever episode, I think.
Second or third, yeah, very early on.
But yeah, so as I say, it doesn't really have much connection to this other than it's a meta riff on the meaning of superhero comics. So see how you get on with it.
In fact, I'm just reminiscing. That was so long ago that I remember recording that minisode and being genuinely nervous about talking about comics. I'm just some bloody idiot who knows nothing about this. And now I'll be going, do you know what? I thought there was some problematic stuff in The Killing Joke and the internet would hate me. I just don't give a shit anymore. I still don't know anything about comics, but I just talk about them anyway. Okay, James, what are you going
to
recommend?
Okay, this actually came to me mid-record, and I think Seb will see where I'm coming from with it, which is that this is a miniseries from 2001, written by someone called Paul Jenkins, who I don't think you've encountered before.
Doesn't ring a bell.
And the series I'm talking about is called The Sentry. And essentially it's the story of a sort of middle-aged, well, maybe not middle-aged, but a sort of an adult guy. He's like married and living a kind of normal life, and then discovers that he's the most powerful superhero that has ever lived. And this is set within the Marvel Universe. It's sort of retroactively revealed that he's this guy called the Sentry who, essentially, they covered up the fact that he's a superhero to him because he's mentally ill. And I think there are quite a lot of parallels with David Dunn in the character of Robert Reynolds, who is the Sentry.
Robert Rodney Reynolds?
I don't know what you're talking about. I assume that's a reference to something.
It's just Ryan Reynolds' middle name is Rodney.
Right, okay.
Sorry.
And again, it kind of deconstructs sort of 60s superheroes through the lens of like this character who ostensibly existed but has been forgotten.
The important thing to note about the Sentry is that he became one of the worst things about Marvel comics.
But
at this point, he's fine. It's just what got done with him afterwards.
Yeah, if this series was all a Sentry that existed, that would be great.
Yeah,
because like it's a really fun and interesting sort of look at superheroes in a kind of metatextual, but not in a Grant Morrison way.
Well, like, in fact, there was even Legion-ish to me as well, James. Bit Legion-ish?
Yeah, a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm. If you like Legion.
Okay.
I mean, there was an interesting thing, which is when Sentry was announced, they kind of pitched it as, did they even say Stan Lee created him? They pitched it as if,
yes, like, it they was did. I think it was Marvel. It Stan Lee and John Romita were supposed to have.
No, it was. Done they it. Said it was a penciler called Artie Rosen.
That's right. They invented the pencil. Yeah, but they invented the pencil. But who actually did it? It was somebody with quite a retro style.
It might have been
someone
John
like
Romita.
Javier Pulido or something. No, well, it wouldn't be John Romita because I think he was dead by then.
Yeah,
but I've got a
good
question. Anyway, that's
yeah.
That's
so like they came up with this like fake backstory for the character, which, like I say, it was quite sort of meta at the time, but a lot of people treat it now as if, like, oh, the Sentry was a hoax character, and it's like, it wasn't a hoax. It was like a marketing spin.
It was kind of the way that they did the announcement in Wizard. There was a feature in Wizard magazine specifically that was, this old stuff has been found. And that was kind of a hoax, but it was a hoax as a marketing gimmick, essentially. It wasn't that the whole existence of the character was a hoax, it's that the hoax was a gimmick to sell the character that they had created.
Yeah, and I think as soon as you read the comic, you see why it wasn't a hoax. Like, it was, it's kind of like,
it's part of the,
yeah, it's part of the,
part of the premise, isn't
it? Yeah, part
it?
Of the premise, yeah. Anyway, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff to read into that, especially in the context of it being a comic that came out, like, the year after Unbreakable.
Can I just read? Just because I was just hopping onto his Wikipedia page because I was trying to find who had done like the artwork and stuff. When I was talking about like what was used with him, what was done with him afterwards, like when he came into the Avengers, there's a line in the Sentry's Wikipedia entry that says, "Newsarama ranked the Sentry as the third worst Avengers member, describing him as a schizophrenic powerhouse who somehow managed to make that combination of words actually mean a whiny, self-possessed MacGuffin character whose personal lameness is only outweighed by the lameness of the conceits that are required for his existence to make any sense."
Wow.
Sounds pretty lame.
Say what you mean, guys.
I mean, the problem was Bendis got his hands on him, wasn't it? And then Paul Jenkins.
Among other things.
Paul Jenkins
and then
also
Paul Jenkins.
Went, shit.
We yeah, shouldn't help. Exactly.
This was when Paul Jenkins wrote, was like the next big thing, though. So,
yeah, that never really went anywhere, did it?
Yeah.
Okay, shall we move on to our final section of the podcast, which is the pitch? I mean, this one's pretty on the button. What I want to know, you guys, we are now getting an Unbreakable sequel in a way. But what I want to know is, pitch me the Unbreakable sequel that has nothing to do with James McAvoy. Pitch me the Unbreakable sequel that is purely a sequel to Unbreakable. And maybe this could have come out in 2002, you know, a couple of years afterwards. Maybe it could be coming out now. You're free to pick to do whatever you want with these characters. The sequel to Unbreakable without James McAvoy. What have you got for me, Seb?
So I would look at the next sort of, having already established himself as a superhero by resolving a kidnapping case, I would follow on to the next kind of, kidnapping rescue that David Dunn goes on after he's turned, Elijah into the police. So he actually, goes to Indiana, and investigates a case where several women have been kidnapped by an insane reverend and kept in an underground bunker, and he rescues them, and we follow one of them, the adventures of one of them as she tries to adjust to adult life, having been held captive since she was a teenager. She might move to New York, maybe. You know, could be a bit more lighthearted, bit of comedy potential to it. I don't know, but yeah.
I realise in retrospect I teed you up for that, Seb. You did knock it out of the park. My only worry is that would mean it's not set in Philadelphia, so we're probably not getting Shyamalan back to direct.
That's a good point.
Which is an issue. But yeah, I do like that. I also like how Like, it basically, if you switch out the word females for Bruce Willis, the
Bruce Willis is the strongest.
Yeah. It's perfect. It's perfect. I mean, if they can negotiate some kind of rights deal for that song for the sequel. Yeah. James, you're going to struggle. What have you got?
The way I would do a sequel to Unbreakable is to go full cinematic universe on it. So David Dunn meets all the characters from all of the other M. Night Shyamalan films, like, and they form an Avengers-style team with Mr. Glass putting it together for obvious reasons. So, like, they have the lady from Lady in the Water. I assume there's a lady in it. I've not actually seen it. They have...
yeah, so it's Bryce Dallas Howard. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So they have the lady. They have one of the aliens from Signs. They have Ghost
Bruce
Willis.
They have
Bruce
the last
Willis.
Airbender.
Ghost Bruce Willis. Well, you can't have that because of the rights problems. It's got all be his original characters. They have Will Smith from After Earth because we know he's not... No stranger to appearing in a bad superhero franchise. And they team up and fight some James McAvoy, I guess? You know, someone.
No, I said James McAvoy can't be in it. That's
okay,
the one.
He's not. They fight one of James McAvoy's other personalities.
Yeah.
Who is not James McAvoy.
Oh, right, okay, fine. I'll let
Michael
you have
Fassbender.
It. are you bringing anyone in for The Visit?
Yeah, the house from The Visit. That's where they live.
The house from The Visit. I like the rapping kid in The Visit.
Yeah, he can be in it too. Sure, bring them all in.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets a poopy diaper rubbed in his face.
Oh, M. Night Shyamalan is in it as every character that he's cameoed as.
He's played in all of his films.
Yeah. I mean, I like that, James. I mean, Sebwin.
Oh, come on!
I mean, mostly because...
Never
it's
underestimate
gonna be...
going for the obvious joke.
You already did it.
I just think going from Unbreakable to Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is going to be a fascinating transition. Damn it.
God.
To be clear, because it's a sequel to a superhero movie, the title actually has to be Unbreakable : Kimmy Schmidt. Like
it.
Captain America, The Winter Soldier, Thor, The Dark World.
I would genuinely watch a superhero movie where Kimmy Schmidt gets superhero powers.
I mean, that could happen in Kimmy Schmidt. I think they should call it, to be fair, I think the sequel should be called 2 Unbreakable with the number 2.
2 Unbreakable, 2 Furious.
Yeah, exactly.
Electric Boogaloo. Yep, okay, great. Well, so Seb wins the pitch this week, and that is it for this week's podcast. If you're enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/ Cinematic Universe.
We're running a competition where you can win an exclusive... Is that exclusive? You can win a Marvel Legends Spider-Man figure if you're one of our Patreon backers.
And also, on the subject of Patreon... I hope by the time this episode comes out, we'll also have put out, it's already recorded, our Batman Nightfall episode exclusive to Patreon backers. So if you want to hear me and David Hartrick talking for about an hour and three quarters about 1990s Batman comics, then subscribe.
Yeah, and I think another nice little thing that we could ask our listeners to do in terms of getting back to us, if there are any Patreon exclusive stuff that you particularly like James to talk about a certain thing, or me to talk about a certain thing, or Seb to continue doing his chats with David about these big kind of crossover eventy stuff, like if there's something that you're like, oh, that'd be great, then suggest it to us, and if we think it's a good idea, we'll probably do it, because we're looking for ideas for our Patreon exclusive stuff. Anyway,
so. the whole point of it is to give people what they want to hear. So,
we want to enrich your podcasting lives. So help us do that. So that was Patreon. You can find more episodes of the podcast at cinematicuniverse.com. You can get in touch via Facebook, on Twitter at @cine_verse, or you can send us an email to editorial@cinematicuniverse.com. And guys, what I thought we haven't done for a while, we haven't plugged our personal Twitter accounts, have we? I'm @JoeCunningham14. Where can our listeners find the both of you?
I'm @JamesHunt.
And I'm at Seb Patrick. We got our names on Twitter. Well, James didn't originally have his. James used to be J.R. Hunt, but then
I fought off.
He got his name from the dead Formula One driver.
I fought off a dead Formula One driver gimmick account to get mine.
I've never been able to wrestle mine back. I should also say I've started really getting back into Letterboxd. So if you want to follow me on Letterboxd, that's JoeCunningham14 as well. I've become a little bit addicted. I love it.
I feel like I really like Letterboxd as a thing, but I feel like the point at which I lost track of actually tracking what I was watching, it was then impossible to recover again. Yes. Also, I stopped seeing as many movies because I had a child. So my Letterboxd account just became, oh, I've rewatched half of an animated film or that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, if you
but it is good. I like it as a site, and it's a nice way to keep up with what people are doing. So I'll go and have a look at your profile myself.
But it'll just be good for our listeners. They'll see, oh, that's why Joe's been banging on about that certain thing, because David Lynch is stuck in his head, or he's been watching, as I have recently, lots of Marilyn Monroe movies. Anyway, I digress. Thanks for listening, you guys, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
No capes!
Isn't that my decision?
Do you remember Thunderhead? Tall, storm powers, nice man, good with kids?
Listen, eh?
November 15 for 58. All was well, another day saved, when his cape snagged on a missile fin.
Thunderhead was not the brightest bulb.
Stratogale, April 23rd, 57. Cape caught in a jet turbine.
You can't generalise about these things.
Metaman, express elevator. Diner guy, snagged on takeoff. Splashdown, sucked into a vortex. No capes!
You missed your true calling.
That got very close to your Adam Buxton. Oh, that was too much fun. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with The Incredibles.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.